Okay, we'll pick up. We're continuing in our sermon series on the letter to the Hebrews. Don't know who the author was. I just know he's a really good preacher. I can tell when I read this, like, man, this guy can preach. And what we talked about last week is just how God disciplines us and he makes us strong. It's through the trials that we go through in life. God uses those to make us stronger. But we don't want to separate God's discipline in our lives and making us stronger from helping to strengthen others. And that's why I said last week to stay in your lane as you're running the race, to fix your eyes upon Jesus and don't go to the right or left. Run that straight line, because the people behind you that aren't as mature spiritually as what you are can get tripped up if you get out of your lane running the race. If you get distracted by other things, people who look to you for leadership are running behind you in the race, they can get tripped up. You've ever seen in the Olympics where they're running and then someone about in the middle of the pack even trips up, and then what happens? Everybody behind them just like, blah, 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 blah. They fall everywhere. And that's what happens when we get tripped up. Those that are less mature, that are behind us in the race, they get tripped up as well. So when God disciplines us, he's not just doing it for our own good. It's so that we don't trip up those who follow behind us. And then the writer of Hebrews proceeds to go to the story of Esau. Now, if you want to turn there, you can. I've got it on the scriptures to Genesis 25. Then we're going to end up in our main text, Hebrews chapter 12. This story of Esau. Now, who is Esau? He was a man of weak faith. This is not a story. Man, thank God someone wasn't around when I was 19 making the stupidest decisions of my life. All right? And just writing those things down so that people 4,000 years later will still make fun of me, all right? Esau, unfortunately, has that distinction. And so when we get to heaven and we see Esau there, you know, say, hey, Esau, you know, sorry, you know, his whole life he just probably has to deal with that, right? God just didn't choose him to get the blessing that Jacob did. But part of it was his own stupidity, okay? And what happened is, just so you know the story, Jacob and Esau were twins. Here's a picture of them I've got for you on the board. Jacob, or Esau, is this big old hairy, big man, man's man, liked to hunt and fish. He was a man of the field. He was born first, right? And then here comes his twin brother behind him, and he's not Esau, okay? He likes to hang around. And just to read a little bit about him, as the firstborn, Esau has the rights of the firstborn, which means he gets a double inheritance of all the other kids. Okay, we don't do that anymore, and as a firstborn, I'm just greatly disappointed, all right, that I don't get double what my sister gets, but I'm not going to complain. All right, here we go. So when the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in the tents. He liked to hang around the house. Two twin brothers raised by the same parents. Don't you know that? You raise your kids exactly the same, they just come out different, right? And Isaac loved Esau, that's the daddy, and Isaac, this big old rich guy, right? He's just got tons of flocks and herds, and I mean, he loves his son, he loves the hunter, and why does he love his son? Because he killed meat and bring it to him, all right? That's what we like, people to bring me the meat. That's what men like, okay? And so my son brings me the meat, he's my favorite, but Rebecca, the mama, loved Jacob. In other words, Jacob was a homebody. We say it again another way. Jacob loved his mama. He was a what? Mama's boy, right? A mama's boy. Now, once when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau comes in from the field and he was exhausted. And let me tell you what, when you've been out hunting all day, which I do, nothing makes me hungrier than sitting all day in a tree. I don't know what it is. You're not expending any energy. You're just sitting there going like this all day long. But at the end of the day, I want to eat some food, okay? So Esau comes in. He says to Jacob, let me eat some of that red stew, for I am exhausted. It says, therefore, his name was Edom. He was given this nickname, all right? Now, if you grew up in the country like I did, almost everybody had a nickname, right? And your nickname, how many of you grew up with a nickname? Raise your hand if you got a nickname. How many of you, your nickname was a very positive nickname? Almost nobody, right? Yeah, okay. One or two, all right? For most of us, you know, they called you a nickname that made fun of you. And for whatever reason, it would just stick, okay? And so this was his nickname for the rest of his life, Red, all right? They called him Red because he sold his half his, and literally he gave away millions of dollars for this stew. He says, I want some of this stew. I'm exhausted. I'm worn out. Esau is controlled by his flesh. I mean, he's just come in from the tent. I mean, from hunting, all the tents around. Jacob never goes far from home. He's got a millionaire daddy, and he's like, the only food in the world is this soup that I see right here in front of me. And Jacob says, well, sell me your birthright now. For a bowl of soup, millions of dollars for a bowl of soup? And Esau said, I am about to die. Any of your kids ever do that? They're so hungry. Mom, if I don't get some pizza right now, I'm just going to die. Guys do that especially. I just got to have some. Some of you say, what do you mean my kids? My husband's that way when he comes home every day. I've just got to have. And he's like, of what use is a birthright or an extra $1 million? What do I need? Look at the short-sightedness, how he's controlled by his flesh, the lack of discipline in his life. And Jacob says, swear to me now. This is going to be a contractual deal. In the back of Jacob's mind, he's like, this has got to be the stupidest brother the world has ever known. He might actually do it. He's going to pay me $1 million for a bowl of soup. So Esau swore to him, and he sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau the bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way. What an idiot. How could he do this? And it says, thus Esau despised his birthright. He just gave it away for nothing. And that is the example that the writer is using here in Hebrews chapter 12. Let's go back there, Hebrews 12. And he's making three things that the church has to do. He's saying, church, man, you just got to get this right. First of all, see to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God. In other words, be evangelists. Share the word of God. Invite people to Christ in your interactions throughout the week. Invite them to be a part of the church family. Share the grace of God so that they receive the grace of God. And then secondly, when you come together as a church body, you can let no root of bitterness spring up and cause trouble. Don't do it. This is one of our major jobs as shepherds of the church. That's why we're called shepherds, is because we watch out for the sheep. It's to not let there be any bitterness or disunity in this body. As soon as we sniff it, we do like Barney Fife said, and we do what? Nip it in the bud. You got to take care of it right away. Don't even let that root get started. I was just thinking about this sermon this week, walking through the town of Canova. I love our beautiful city. But if you go to walk on our sidewalks, you will see a number of places where there are trees that were planted many years ago right next to the cement sidewalk. And cement is very strong, right? But it's not as strong as that oak tree or that maple tree that's grown up over the years. So when you're walking around, if you don't pay attention when you're walking the sidewalks of Canova, you will break your ankle. You can't even run on our sidewalks. Why? Because those trees have grown up and cracked that cement. Listen, your family, your marriage, your workplace, your church can be like that. You say, man, we are rock solid. We are cement. But let me tell you what, a root of bitterness, if you let that grow for any number of years, it will crack the strongest of foundations. As a church body, we have to guard against bitterness in our own lives, in our family lives, in our church life. It just causes trouble, and by it, many become defiled. That's what we talked about last week. It's just a few leaders get into a little fight, and many people get hurt. Grandchildren quit coming to church. Generations go away and never come back. You can't have bitterness as a part of your heart. Let it go. Forgive. Reconcile. Work it out so that many don't become defiled by your own personal agendas. And then he says, third. Now you think of all the things that he could have said, man, this is what you got to do. You got to share the gospel. You got to make sure no root of bitterness is going on. And then the third thing that he mentions is see that no one is sexually immoral or unholy like Esau. Why is this so important? Why do we have to lay the foundation? To see that our single people do not have sex outside of God's institution of marriage, one man, one woman, one lifetime. Why is that lifted up? Like three things you're going to mention, and that's one of them? Share the gospel, forgive one another, and then don't have sex outside of marriage? I mean, that one, like, why is that so important? And this is what the writer is communicating today. Man, I'm going to lock down on this. What the writer is communicating is this. When you look at Esau, he had no control over his fleshly desires. That's what was at the heart of it. He let his flesh rule his emotions. And he let his emotions rule his decision making. And what the writer of Hebrews is communicating to the church is if you're going to do anything, you've got to teach people not to allow their flesh to dictate their decisions. They have to be pure. They have to be set apart. They have to be moral. They have to be holy, not like Esau, who sold out $1 million for one night of passion, for one pill, for one beer. Just let the flesh rule over his life. And he says, for you know that afterwards, when he desired to inherit a blessing, he was rejected. Couldn't unring that bell. As soon as he had that soup in his stomach, as he walked away, he despised it. He's like, man, I messed this up. Don't raise your hands on this one, but how many of you can go back to a decision you made in your life? Just a decision made in the emotional state of the flesh at the time. And you're like, man, that was stupid. And you know what? Our God is a God of second chances. But there's only one time I can read that scripture where he actually turned back time. Rarely happens. He does not unring that bell. So what he's saying here is communicate to your children. Don't ring a bell that can't be unrung. Pass this on. Understand this, church, we cannot allow our flesh to dictate our decisions. He was rejected, and he found no chance to repent, though he sought it with tears. Man, there have been times that I've just made dumb decisions, and I've cried about it. And you know what me crying about it fixed? Nothing. So what he's saying is instill in your children, in your church members, the discipline it takes to overcome the desires of the flesh. Now, I could list the desires of the flesh, but you all know what they are. We're experts at them. It's ingrained in us. So now what I'm about to talk about along this subject matter, I'm from here so I can say it. If I bring in somebody from New York City or from L.A., y'all be offended. But I'm from Southern West Virginia, so I can get by with this. Got a picture here. Lana White was over in Ethiopia, and I've taken a few people over to Ethiopia. Dave, you've been with me over there. Remember these little kids sitting up front? Thousands of them, right? I mean, it'll be 30,000 people there, and they sit and listen to the Word of God how long? Do you remember? All day, 8 hours. They sit in church like you're sitting, except they're sitting on hay on the ground. Thousands of them, they sit there just like this, 8 hours. Same way in India. And Dave, when you go over there, and I asked Lana this morning. I didn't go over this with her in advance. I'll ask you now. You can make me look stupid, okay? When you watch those kids sitting there for 8 hours, what came to your mind while those children were sitting there? And you also thought, what about home? Yeah, I mean, about America. Yeah. It's what they all say. Man, our kids could never do that. You know why our kids could never do that? Because we don't teach them to do that. There's not something different about the DNA of Ethiopians or the kids in India. It's that we don't expect it out of them. But by golly, if I have kids just sit here 30 minutes, they're like, blah, 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 blah. And you're like, my kid won't do that. By golly, those Ethiopian kids will do it. They'll sit there. You saying their kids are smarter than yours? What is the difference? Again, I'm from here. I think I can get away from this. This is just fact. sociological fact. Regions who have the lowest rates of disciplined kids also have the highest rates of childhood obesity, the highest rates of drug use among their teenagers, the highest rates of out-of-wedlock births, and the lowest educational scores. But those same children, they live in a disciplined environment. They excel. They do well in the areas they should, and they're disciplined in areas that they shouldn't be excelling in. Just in our churches alone, this is West Virginia Baptist churches. Frank, we did this study a few years ago. The average age of first sex is 18 years old. And our average age of first marriage is 24. Do the math. This is in our churches, not the general population. This is in our churches. You see, I gotta say it. Our area is one of the worst, if not the worst, in the country when it comes to adults having discipline in their lives, which is a direct result of not being disciplined when they were children. The reason we have adults dealing with a lack of discipline and drug use in their lives is the same reason we have teenagers who aren't controlling their flesh and experimenting sexually when they're teenagers. It's because, go to Walmart, you'll see it, I promise. Kids don't learn discipline when they're 3 and 4 years old. We are one of the worst, if not the worst. Now, when I say discipline, I say this all the time, but I got to reemphasize, in our area, and this is part of our problem, when you say people in our area, discipline, it's a dirty word. We make it synonymous with punishment. Consistent discipline is molding the attitudes, the actions, and the beliefs of someone to prevent behaviors or to encourage positive behaviors. Punishment is looking backwards. I'm going to make you pay for something that you did wrong. We think discipline always, most parents, they only quote unquote discipline when they punish. I'm going to hurt you because you did something wrong. That's not discipline, that's punishment. Discipline is sitting down with your child, projecting what the behavior should be in the future, and equipping them with the skills they need so they can be successful in the ways that God wants them to have success. Today is the day, this will make a lot of you feel really old. Lucas is at a youth leader event, YLC, in Ravenswood Baptist. He's leading worship there. Very proud of him. He turns 18 today. I've got 3 adult children. Can you believe that? I know you guys think I'm old, but for the people my age, give me some pity. Greg Cantley, what has happened to us? I can't believe it. I've got 3 adult children. But I don't want to give Lucas the big head, so I'll say this while he's not here. I've not had to punish him one time since he's 5 years old. He has not disobeyed me one time. There's never been, he's forgotten sometimes, but he has never just not done what I've asked him to do, not one time since he was 5. And I thank the Lord for that, and I'm not just giving myself a pat on the back. It's much more due to his mother and the grace of God, but I thank God for that. But I would say this about my other 2 adult children. I may have punished them once or twice a year after they turned 5 years old. That's it. Is very obedient. Now, Johnny is here today. Before 5, oh my goodness. It was like John, I used to set the alarm clock every hour on the hour. And it wouldn't just be discipline, it would be punishment. And let me tell you what, she earned it. All right? I mean, we had Titus, who was the easy kid. You tell him something one time, you know, Tyson, you do this, maybe a little bit of discipline and punishment, but 2, 3, you know, we're working with him. Jonna, was God's humility factor in our lives, all right? She would, I'm not even going to begin to tell you this story. She gets embarrassed of the things that she used to do. But you know what? Since she's been five, she's been a jewel to me. She's been a joy. Rarely did I have to punish her. Doesn't mean that she didn't make mistakes. But as I look back and I thank the Lord that I'm not constantly having to spank my kids once they hit kindergarten and above, the key to it was just, I had a wife who read incessantly because we valued parenting so much. We read the Bible, we listened to tapes, podcasts, read books. We ran them through the theological sieve because, you know, we all know you read a lot of secular books and you're like, there's just a lot of stupid parenting advice, right? So you run it through the biblical sieve of, okay, does that line up with what God would do? But man, just read a lot about how do we discipline our kids on the front end so we're not belting them on the back end? How do we train them up with the skills they need to be successful in life? What is we're doing? And that's what this passage we're looking at today is teaching, the importance of this. We're teaching them the discipline to have the right attitudes in advance so you'll rarely have to punish wrong behaviors in the past. And I'm just going to tell you right now, one of the greatest things that you can do from the day the child is born is to make them sit still and listen to you read 20 minutes every single day. And we're just incredibly weak on this as a culture. I would not, listen, I love you, I'm one of you, I'm for you, I'm not against you. I would not have had to preach this at our church in Dallas because those parents did it every day. And my kids will tell you, even now, I will sit down with my kids as adults and I'll read them a devotion, something from the Bible every night when we're at home. And they're adults. I read to them the word of God. On the day that Titus was born, I opened the book of Titus, held him in my arms. The first thing I did with him was read him the scriptures. While he was in the womb, I would read him the Bible. Same for Jonna, same for Lucas. As soon as she comes out, Jonna, book of John, in the beginning was the word. And the word was with God. And the word was God. Those were the first words that hit her ear out of the womb. Lucas, I open up the book of Luke, start reading to him. And every day in his life, I would read a chapter from the book of Luke, his namesake. Communicating, you will sit still and you will listen 20 minutes every day. Now, what does reading to your child do? Well, I've got some things on the screen. Maybe you can see them. I'll read them to you here. First of all, it instills personal discipline skills. There are a ton of studies out there will demonstrate this for you. It instills personal discipline. Secondly, it creates significant academic advantages. We all want our kids to do well academically. Give them that advantage in life. It develops their brains. It increases their intellectual capacity. It improves their ability to concentrate. It decreases ADD and ADHD symptoms. Listen, there's some aspects of it that are very real. It runs in my family. I've got it. It drives my wife crazy. I'm just sitting there and my knees are tapping or whatever. But we have to teach our kids that discipline. Reading to them helps with this. It develops their imagination. It expands their horizons for cultural understanding. It improves their vocabulary and their language skills. It develops their imagination in a creative way. It makes them innovators. It is directly correlated with educational advancement and eventual income. There's a direct relationship there. And then finally, and I would say even probably most importantly, it bonds the child with the adult reader for life. How many of you can remember a teacher or a family member who read to you when you were a child? How many of you can remember that? A lot. How many of those memories you have of them are fond memories? You have good memories of those people. You're still bonded to them. I remember my favorite teachers in elementary school. We would just sit down and I would lay my head against their shoulder. You know, all the kids made fun of me, but I bonded with those teachers. Your kids want to bond with you. And listen, moms and dads, Man, I just love teachers. Thank God they're back to work. They need more money than what they got. I know our state has some serious budget problems. This isn't a political statement. It's an investment statement. It's a biblical statement. You have to invest in kids being able to read. If they can't read, they're not going to have success in life very often. I'm going to post something online about from the American Academy of Pediatrics, and it is spot on with developing kids to have the personal discipline skills that they need. See, what discipline keeps you from doing is going back to old ways that you know you need to walk away from. And what the writer of Hebrews is saying is the people are undisciplined, and God was giving them trials, fortifying their love for Christ and driving them away from the things of the world. The silver and gold, take it from me. Josh, as y'all were singing that song, I thought we really should have sung that before the offering, not after the offering. It might have helped a little more. You guys didn't laugh. You want to keep your money. All right, I see how it is. But pain in this life keeps you focused on the next. You ever watch the game show, Let's Make a Deal? You ever watch that? And what they do a lot of times is they'll give the contestant $500 in cash. They don't just say, you've got $500. They don't give them a check. They like out five Ben Franklins. One, two, three, four, five. Everybody counts with them. They're holding that $500. You're like, oh, I need this $500. All right? And so they're sitting there. And then they said, or you can have what is behind door number three. And you can just see the stress on their face. Like, I don't know what I want to do. I don't know what I want to do. And they want to choose what behind them. But I got to have that $500. Why do we watch these stupid shows? What all of you said, like you were like, yeah, I watch it. Why do you watch these stupid shows? You know why you watch it? Because you like sitting on the edge of your seat looking, I wonder what they're going to do. I wonder what I would do. I could use that $500. What could I do with $500? I would just take the $500. Other person, take the door. But I got a car payment to make. I mean, you can just see the stress on their face, what I'm going to do. And then a lot of times they'll say, I'll take door number three. They take it away and they open up and there's a donkey. Wah, wah, wah. And what does it do? It instills fear. It creates drama for the next person that has $500. And they're like, I'll keep the $500. And it's a brand new car. And you're like, oh, regretting life. And that's how we live a lot of our lives. You're holding on to something that you think is valuable that you can't do without. But there's something over there that might be better, but you're just afraid. And so we live our lives based on fear. And really, the reason I think a lot of times we go back to our sin, a lot of times we hang on to our pain, is because we don't know what's behind door number three. I don't know what life's going to look like if I choose a different life. We are slaves to the familiar. We don't want to take chances. So we won't change. That's why we stay in a dead-end job for 40 years. It's why we won't change a college major, even though you don't like the profession. It's why you won't buckle down and study harder, because you know the pain it'll take to do what you want to do. It's why you keep going back to that abusive, unhealthy relationship, because you don't know if God's something better for you in the future. It's because of fear. But what I'm here today to share with you from God's word are three antidotes to fear. This is how God draws fear out of your life. Fear is the opposite of faith. And I'm going to tell you how God drives these things from you. The number one antidote for fear and number two, they usually go together, are pain and loss. God disciplines you, not punish. Punish is back looking whatever. God disciplines you, prepares you for something in the future, prepares you for what's ever behind door number three through pain and loss. People typically won't change until the pain of remaining the same is greater than the pain it takes to change. I'll say that again. We're all basically this way. We won't change unless the pain of remaining the same is greater than the pain it takes to change. Junk food, for example. You all know when you eat a bag of Doritos, it's not good for you. But you're going to keep on eating them. Until the doctor says, you're going to die. And then you're like, well, maybe I should change my eating habits. You knew 20 years ago. Every year, those scales, 3 pounds heavier. You know trouble's coming. The doctor tells you. Your spouse tells you. Your family tells you. Your waiter even says, you don't want dessert anymore, do you? You know trouble's coming. But you won't change until the pain of staying the same is greater than the pain it takes to change. Finances. Until they say you can have no more credit cards. We are going to take your house. Your credit report is negative 200. Then you say, maybe we should change. In marriage, you've heard me say it before. I've seen it for 20-some years. The wife says to the husband privately, honey, I think we need counseling. And he says, no, we don't. And then she comes back a year later, honey, we need counseling. No, we don't. A year later, honey, we need counseling. No, we don't. A year later, honey, I want a divorce. The man says, we need counseling. What changed? He knew he didn't want to go through the pain of staying the same. But I'm here to share with you this morning, there is a better option than pain and loss. Those are two antidotes, but there's something better. You see, the Old Testament Hebrew people, when they were leaving Egypt and they were in the desert, heading their way to the promised land, they kept saying to Moses, we want to go back to, do you remember? Egypt. We want to go back to Egypt. It's that slave mentality. We are slaves to the past. We're slaves to the old habits. We want to go back. We want to go back. I'm going to go back to the habits I know. And the New Testament people in this passage we're looking at today, they were wanting to go back to Judaism. They were wanting to go back to, metaphorically, Mount Sinai, the law, performing sacrifices to make God happy with them. And the writer here is saying, as Moses said to the people in the desert, why would you want to go back when the promised land is in front of you? And so what God did is he disciplined them in the Old Testament days and sometimes punished them so that they learned the hard way. How many of you or your parents ever said that to you? Why do you always have to learn what? The hard way. Your spouse says it to you. You say it to yourself. You look in the mirror, man, Steve, why do you always have to learn the hard way? And what God is saying to you, the same thing that you would say to your kids, I got a better way than pain and loss. Those are two of the three options to get you to break away from those old things, to get out of the fear of change. I've got a better option. The third key is not just personal discipline, though that helps. Just like a good parent, God would rather that you be dependent on him through another means other than pain and loss. What is it? It's this. It's vision. This is the antidote to fear. The key to overcoming fear is a faith-filled vision for a better future for your life, for your kids' life, for your church life, for your business life, for your school's life. A faith-filled vision for a better future. The author writes, he says, don't you know you're wanting to go back to your old ways? You have come to Mount Zion in the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. There is a heaven that is waiting before you. There is a kingdom which is to come that cannot be shaken. It is so much better than anything this world has to offer you. It is so much better. This relationship with Jesus is so much better than the rules of religion. It is so much better. And you've come into innumerable angels and festal gathering. In other words, man, there is a great party with all these angels, and you're right on the edge of it. And they're wanting you to party with them and enjoy life with them. God has this. He's offering it to you. And you've come to the assembly. Now, the word here for assembly is the Greek word ekklesia. What's that the word for? It's the word for church. And you come to the church. We are the firstborn. In other words, we've all got the rights of the firstborn. Do you see that? We all have that inheritance coming. And we're enrolled in heaven. We're on the list. And you've also come to God, the judge of all. That's a benefit. And to the spirits of the righteous made perfect. That's a reference to the Old Testament saints. Everybody's having this party. And then most of all, you're right here at the foot of Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, something better. and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. That's an old sacrificial system that Jeremy talked about a few weeks ago. Abel gave a sacrifice of animals. You don't have to do that anymore because Jesus already did all the work for you on the cross. You don't have to earn your salvation anymore. You don't have to earn God's favor. You don't have to do anything to make him love you. He has given that to you freely. And he's got heaven and a position in his kingdom waiting for you. That's God's vision for you. This is a big deal. And so what the writer is saying here is, yes, God will discipline you. He will give you pain and loss if you have to. But the way you really want to discipline your kids looking forward is you give them a vision for their future. Heaven is so much better. I'm going to ask you a question. In the Bible, I want you to think of an example where someone died and wanted to come back to earth. There is an example of that. Where's an example in the Bible where someone died and wanted to come back to earth? Luke chapter 16, the rich man went to hell and he yells up to Abraham in heaven, "Get me out of here. I'm in agony in this fire." Okay? Because earth, this life now, is better than hell. Everybody get that? Nobody would argue that. And we say this at funerals all the time. Do you ever see someone in the Bible in heaven saying, "Man, I just need to get back down to earth"? No. People pass away and we say at a funeral, "Well, if Aunt Betsy, there's no way she'd want to come back now. We're sorry we lost her, but she would never want to come back." Here's the thing. We all say that, but we don't embrace it for our own lives. We want to live out and embrace the things of the world instead of doing things here in this world now that prepares us for the kingdom which is to come, that unshakable kingdom that Jesus Christ is establishing even now. Give kids a vision. And once you get a vision, then like Moses says, like the writer of Hebrews says, why would you ever want to go back to your old, painful, hurtful ways of life when God has something better for you behind door number three? He says it another way. He says, as it is written, what no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the heart of man even imagined what God has prepared for those who love him. He says, you can't even imagine it. Now, people quote that verse all the time, but look at the very next verse. These things God has revealed to us through the Spirit. In other words, you can't imagine it because the Bible says it for you. God has plans to prosper you and make you successful, not to harm you. For the Spirit searches everything, even the depths of God. Man, folks, listen. God has so much better for you than what you're even getting right now. Do you understand what I'm saying? What is your vision for your life? This is how I disciplined my kids. I've saved it for now because I understood this. Once they get the vision for something better, they won't go back to something that's worse. Dee and I never had to sit around and struggle. Do we prioritize this over spiritual development? Do we prioritize this over their spiritual development? There was never any argument because we had a vision for our kids that could not be shaken. Something eternal, something bigger for them that they could never imagine when they were 3 years old. That's why Dee Willis would read to them every single night, no matter how tired she was. Whether or not Jonna wanted to sit still, she was going to sit still because Dee had a vision for her daughter's life that was bigger than anything Jonna was even able to dream or imagine at that time. You got to have a vision. There's more to this life than this life. Do you believe that? So this is what I do. I sit down with Titus. And this is why I don't have to punish him. I say, "Son, what do you want to do?" He said, "Dad, I want to go to top 10 college." "All right, son, if that's what you got to do, then you got to study for this anatomy test. Now let's get at it." "So no, Dad, I want to play basketball." "That's great. Let's get outside and let's shoot 100 free throws." I don't have to punish him to get him out there to do it. He's doing it because he has a vision and he wants to play high school basketball. Jonna says, "I want to go to Cedarville." I say, "It's too expensive." She says, "I got this vision, Dad." I said, "All right, I got this vision. I ain't going in debt. I'm not going to do it. What do I got to do?" "All right, if this is your vision, you got to get this magic score on your SAT. "Well, I can't do that." "Then you ain't going to Cedarville." And you know what Jonna started doing? What'd you do, little girl? She started studying. She get that SAT back. You know how many times I had to punish her to get her to go study for the SAT? Never, because she had a vision for her life where she wanted to be. Do you understand what I'm saying, church? You got to put that out for the kids. Lucas, he wants to be this piano maestro or whatever. Do you know how many times I've had to make my kid practice piano? Zero. I never had to do it. What I do is I put out for him, Lucas, what do you want to be in 10 years? What do you want to be doing? He has always just wanted to sing in the choir and lead in the garage praise band. He's doing it now. You know why he's doing that? Because I gave him that vision when he was 8 years old. Do you follow church? If you give people a vision for something great, you won't go back to the old ways. These people are shooting the poison in their veins. It's because they've lost the vision for their life. They can't go on to door number three because they're living a life in fear. And God is saying, get this vision in front of you. I've got something great for you. I've got something powerful for you. I've got a future for you. And mom and dads, grandmas, grandpas, teenagers, where you are right now, God has something for you. This is what reading his word, this is just what reading Dr. Seuss can do for you. It gives you a vision for your life. And once you get that vision, you just start seeing your own kids say, I ain't looking back. I don't want that. I'm not choosing this cheap imitation stuff of the world. I want to, and this is what gets me out of, listen. This is why I've been in this community 20 years. Kids who actually have a vision in our area, usually when they grow up and finish school and they've got big dreams, what do? They move away. Why? Because we don't have enough leaders my age around here who are going to them and say, man, let's still keep a vision for Wayne County. Let's still keep a vision for West Virginia and the tri-state area. Why didn't I leave this church 15 years ago? Why didn't I jump out and go to some suburb out in California and live on a beach? Because God gave me a vision for this area. This church has bigger and better things. Sometimes I look at it and say, man, we're so full. What are we going to do? We go to two services. And when we fill up that, we'll do three. We'll plant another church. We'll partner with another place. We have more members join. We're going to reach this tri-state for the glory of Christ and set up a kingdom that cannot be shaken. You got to believe that, church. This is what keeps us from going back to the old ways. You got to fix your eyes on Jesus. This is what vision does. It bonds you with those who share it. It grounds you. It stabilizes you. It builds you up so that when the things of this world are just being thrown at you and the temptation are coming at your kid's way, that you say, no, I've got a vision for a better land, for a kingdom, for a life that will not be shaken. And I just want to encourage you, families, please, whatever you do, don't let your foundation be a vision for something that is not eternal. Can't tell you how many high school athletes, man, have just lived it for Friday Night Lights. And then they graduate and we wonder why they go crazy second semester of their senior year. Because they didn't have a vision past that 10th game or past that 14th game. I helped my son have a vision for high school sports, but that was never his ultimate vision. And my vision that gets me out of bed in the morning is not even this church growing. It's standing before Jesus and him saying, well done. And now here's the job I have for you in my kingdom that I'm establishing here on earth. Every day is a job interview. Every day is a way that I'm demonstrating to Jesus, you can trust me not only in this life, but to give me something of a responsibility in the next, in that kingdom. So he closes the chapter with this. He says, therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. Nothing's going to tear this down. And thus, let us offer to God acceptable worship, sold out, undistracted, disciplined, focused on him with reverence and in awe. Why? Because our God is a consuming fire and he is in the business of burning everything away in your life that doesn't give glory to him. And he can either do that through pain, he can burn things away through loss, or best of all, he gives you such a glorious vision for your life that the things of the world grow strangely dim in the light of the glory of Christ. And that's the vision I have for my kids. That's the vision I have for this church. It's the vision I have for my marriage. We just want to glorify Jesus.